giving me the opportunity to talk here today. So today I'm going to be talking about chiral magnetic and topological order in modern slaters. And so before I go through the outline, I'd just like to thank my collaborators. It actually involves a lot of former perimeter people. So my supervisor at University of Toronto, Erwin Permacandy, and this trio of perimeter, former perimeter members. So Lukasz Cincio, who was a postdoc here, and since moved to Los Alamos Labs. Zlatko Papic, who was also a postdoc here, has moved to the University of Leeds. And Pratik Rath, who was a summer student with us and was in the PSI program here, is now a PhD student at Berkeley. So in terms of outline, so first I'm going to talk a little about motivation. So this will be kind of like intro slides. So I'm going to talk a little about integer and fractional quantum Hall physics. I'm going to talk about realizations of some of this physics in ultra-cold atoms, and specifically this Haldane model, which I'll talk about. Then I'm going to kind of, so this is going to be a general kind of intro, then I'm going to kind of zoom in on a specific model as an example, this Haldane-Hubbard model, talk a little bit about the physics of that, this spin physics. We're going to find there a particular phase, this tetrahedral phase, which I'll explain. We're going to talk about kind of disordering this. And then at the end, kind of before I wrap up, I'm going to kind of zoom out from the specific model and think about more generally how kind of chiral spin liquid phases, which I'll talk about, can be realized as kind of through kind of disordering these what I call kind of parent states. And then I'll conclude. And if you have any questions during the talk, please feel free to ask. So motivation. The kind of physics thing we can talk about today is kind of generalizations, I guess, of quantum Hall physics. So I'll go back to kind of the original quantum Hall, so which is integer quantum Hall effect, found in the early 80s. So this is just a 2D electron gas in a uniform magnetic field, so this is the kind of setup. And it was found that as a function of magnetic field, you get plateaus in the Hall conductivity, which are precisely quantized. So quantization better than one part in a trillion. So good, in fact, that it's used nowadays as a standard measure of resistance. So this is kind of remarkable, physics. And this is sample independent, basically. So it doesn't matter how you generate this electron gas, this quantization still holds. And so this is kind of remarkable. And what's more remarkable, maybe, is that it can be understood in terms of non-interacting electrons, just in Landau levels. And so then kind of a question arises after this discovery is that, can you see this kind of physics in systems without Landau levels? That's true. And so, in fact, band insulators can also exhibit this kind of integer quantum Hall physics, so precise quantization of the Hall conductivity. An example I'm going to talk about later today is this Haldane honeycomb model. Or sometimes called a churn insulator. And this is just a schematic of the band structure. And this gives rise to what's called a quantum anomalous Hall effect. So this is, again, a quantized Hall conductivity, but in this case, in the absence of a net magnetic field. So there's no Landau levels in the system, okay? So this is the integer quantum Hall physics without Landau levels. This is kind of nice, I guess. So recently, Duncan Haldane won the Nobel Prize, partially for this work and partially for his work on spin chains. And in fact, in the kind of Nobel Prize website, if you look at the detailed explanation of why they were given the prize, they actually have this diagram. And this is a recent experimental result where they showed the quantum anomalous Hall effect occurring in this case, it's not quite his model, but a slightly varied model. And so in all of these cases, this kind of precise quantization is due to a kind of topology of the band structure. And so the Hall conductivity can be related to some sort of topological property of the band structure. It's not something that I'll go into in my talk, but just pointing it out. And then there's also been generalizations of this kind of thing. So for example, you can include spin and get quantum spin Hall effect. You can go to three dimensions and get three-dimensional kind of topological insulators and quantum Hall kind of physics, even four-dimensional. So there's a lot of physics here, okay. But this is still all in the non-interacting regime, okay. So this physics can still be understood in terms of non-interacting band structures and their properties, okay. So now we want to think about going kind of a step further, which is adding interactions to these kind of systems, okay. And so when are interactions going to be important? So interactions are usually most important when kinetic energy is in some sense quenched, or kinetic energy isn't going to distinguish your ground state very well, okay. So for example, if I have systems in like a Landau level systems where the Landau levels are basically flat, they're not dispersion, they don't disperse at all, okay, dispersionless. So I have a large number of states basically with the same kinetic energy, okay. And so there's a huge degeneracy of states if I just have thinking about kinetic energy. And so in that case, interactions are going to play an incredibly important role in selecting the kind of ground state and the kind of physics I'm going to see, okay. And so they can actually quench Arecibo kind of lambda level physics, okay, for the naturally kind of dispersionless, right? And that leads to the fractional column Hall effect. So this is a kind of a trace like earlier. So this is, again, you see kind of here plateaus, and instead of being an integer multiples of e squared over h, they're fractional multiples of e squared over h, okay. And then, so this is the kind of interacting generalization of the integer column Hall effect. And what about if we saw that we could have integer column Hall effect without lambda levels? So can we have this kind of fractional column Hall physics without lambda levels? Okay, and so the answer is yes, but again, we need to do something special to the band structure in order to kind of quench this kinetic energy. So this is kind of, so this would be kinetic energy quenched due to flat band physics. So in other words, we can take a band structure kind of like this, we can tune the hopping, so we can tune the terms in the Hamiltonian, so that we can, in this example, completely flatten, say, the lowest band, okay? So again, here there's a large number of states that, in terms of kinetic energy, have almost exact same kinetic energy. So interactions are gonna be extremely important in selecting out kind of which states we're in, okay? And so these are often called fractional Turing insulators, right? And so in both of these cases, if I fractionally fill, say, a lambda level, or fractionally fill one of these smooth dispersionless bands, interactions can actually lead to a kind of new type of order, or topological order, it's often called, and a fractionalization of the fermions. And so there's a number of kind of key characteristics of this kind of new type of topological order. So one of them is a topology-dependent grand state degeneracy. Okay, so depending on the, so these are all two-dimensional systems I should mention. So this is, for the rest of the talk, we're gonna be living in two dimensions, okay? So we're all in flatland. So there's a topology-dependent grand state degeneracy. So depending on the topology of the two-dimensional space that I put the system on, the grand state degeneracy will change, okay? As opposed to say if I just have an easing ferromagnet, you know, all the spins can point up, all the spins can point down. Whether I put the system on a plane or on a sphere or on a torus, right? There's always just those two degenerate grand states, okay? And this is something that we'll actually use later on. I'll talk about it a little bit more. Other unusual properties that the excitations in the bulk of the system usually have kind of unusual statistics, statistics that are not those of a fermion or a boson, but something in between. And also these states are robust against any local perturbation. That's maybe kind of different to some of what you might have heard of. Some of these kind of topological insulator phases are protected by symmetries. So if you break a certain symmetry, that kind of how you classify the phase kind of goes away, or it can be then smoothly connected to, say, just a trivial system. But these kinds of orders are robust against any kind of local perturbation, okay? So there's no kind of symmetry in protecting them. It's some sort of intrinsic property of the grand state, okay?
There's a gap?
In all the states I'm gonna be talking about, they're gonna be gap states, yeah, yeah. So you're protected by the gap, basically, yeah. So this is kind of, you know, overview of kind of quantum Hall physics, both the non-interacting and this interacting stuff. So I want to think about what kind of, this is all nice so far, and how can we kind of realize this kind of physics? So one of the kind of key motivations for us was kind of recent advances in, not in these, you know, solid state kind of 2D electron gases, but actually in cold atom physics. So there's been a lot of progress recently on realizing artificial magnetic fields in cold atom systems. So there's a different variety of ways of realizing, so different groups of different kind of schemes or techniques to realize these artificial magnetic fields, which all basically boil down to kind of imprinting some sort of phase on the wave function, okay? So that's led to the kind of realization of a number of kind of really beautiful models. So for example, the Hofstadter model. So this is kind of bosons hopping on a square lattice with flux phi per plaquette. I think in this case it was pi over 2 per plaquette. So you get this kind of band structure, and they're actually able to measure they're able to tune the Hamiltonian from the topologically trivial to topological phase and measure the Turing number in both cases. So in the trivial phase, they got a Turing number of 0 of the lowest band, and in the topologically non-trivial phase, they got 0.99 plus or minus 0.01 or some of that, okay? So essentially 1, okay. And so then there's also been other experiments on looking at Bose Einstein condensation, what happens if you put in a really strong magnetic field. And what I'm gonna be focusing on today is the realization of the Haldane model, which I briefly mentioned a second ago. So this is a model that was written down by Duncan Haldane in the late 80s. And like I said, this is an example of a quantized Hall connectivity without lambda levels, okay? And I also mentioned that it's sometimes called a Turing insulator. And so this is just a system that breaks time reversal symmetry, so explicitly, not spontaneously, and has this quantized sigma xy. That's just kind of, I mean, nomenclature. Okay, but so what are the ingredients of the model? Okay, so it's on a honeycomb lattice. There's a first term that's just nearest neighbor hopping on a honeycomb lattice, okay? There's a second term that's next nearest neighbor hopping on a honeycomb lattice, but this has a very particular phase structure to it, okay? And this is this e to the I kind of phi, okay? So if I hop along these arrows, okay, I pick the electrons or particles pick up a flux of phi, or a phase of phi, I should say, and if they hop in the opposite direction, they pick up minus phi, okay? So if I have, say, you know, a particle that hops in this kind of three-site loop, it'll pick up, you know, phi, phi, phi. So the total flux and flows in this loop is 3 phi, okay? And if I go in the same direction, so this would be counterclockwise, I guess, in this smaller loop, so if I go, say, here or here, I pick up no flux, it's just nearest neighbor hopping. Then if I go back here, I'll pick up minus phi. Okay, so this kind of big triangle encloses a flux of 3 phi, and these smaller guys minus phi, okay? So then the key ingredient you can see is that if I look at an entire honeycomb, okay, the 3 phi cancels with these minus phis. And so to thread one honeycomb, I have zero net flux, okay? And so that's why in this particular system, lambda levels don't form, okay? So through each unit cell, there's zero net flux, okay? So I'll just have a regular band structure rather than lambda levels, okay? And then there's also an additional term that I won't, you know, in my case, I'll be saying this is zero, but in the original model, there's also a side sublattice offset term. So this is some energy term that favors, say, the A sublattice over the B sublattice, okay? And so this model was actually, so it was written down in the late 80s. It's very difficult to realize in a solid state system because, you know, here the distances between atoms are, you know, angstroms. And so you need, you know, huge fluxes, you know, you need these giant fluxes through each you know, very small unit cells. So in a solid state system, this has not been realized, but in cold atoms, it was recently realized by Tillman and Ensinger's group about 2 years ago now. And so I won't go through all the details of the experiment, but there's, you know, you probably know that in cold atoms, they can create a kind of artificial lattice, so an optical lattice using laser beams. And so here they do the same thing, except they kind of introduce some shaking. So the lattice, instead of being static, is kind of shaking. And if you time average and it's so shaking at some frequency, and as long as that frequency is, so if you time average over that frequency, you know, you effectively create a kind of staggered flux pattern. And it kind of, you know, as long as your experimental time is, you know, short compared to the shaking, you can realize kind of a time independent Hamiltonian. And so then they measured a number of different properties of the model, so gap closing points, things like Berry curvature, which I won't go through. But and this was a kind of really beautiful experiment, and a really, you know, a very quantitative realization of this kind of, you know, intercom Hall physics without lambda levels. Okay, and it took, you know, a long time. This was, like I said, late 80s. Okay, to realize this kind of model. Okay, and so then just like before, you know, we had this. We were talking about intercom Hall physics and band structures, and we want to ask, well, what happens if we add interactions to these systems, okay? Can we see kind of fractional quantum Hall-like physics? And so that's what I'm gonna talk about today, okay? Yep.
So these are charge neutral, right?
That's correct, yeah. So these are out of the charge neutral. So there's no, there's no actual, you know, magnetic field. So this periodic lattice shaking is what kind of imprints phases to the atoms as they hop.
Can you say a little bit more on how they apply the phase?
Yeah, so essentially, so what's happening here is that the, you know, if I think of a standard, what's the best way of explaining? Yeah, so essentially, so what they're doing is they're, so there's some sort of like potential that's set up by the, lasers, which would be the kind of a lattice potential, say. And so now I want to introduce some sort of, so now what's happening is that these lasers are actually retroreflected off some mirrors that are attached to piezoelectrics. So those piezoelectrics shake at some frequency. And so these, you know, the lattice potentials kind of picks up some time-dependent kind of shifts. Kind of like this, okay. So then I can think about, you know, what does this do to say something like, you know, my, you know, momentum, okay, under a kind of like, you know, time-dependent shift like this. And so momentum will basically be shifted, you know, to kind of, you know, P plus some shift that I'll call maybe kind of A, okay, which will be some time dependent kind of shift. Okay. And so then I can, you know, reinterpret, you know, this is kind of some V, kind of X tilde and Y tilde. And I can reinterpret this, you know, this, so depending on the period of the, you know, the change in this A. So if it's, you know, very fast, I can average over it. And so I can think of this as being like a static, like vector potential, a static shift in P.
A depends on Xt and beta.
So I can't remember the exact relationship, but I mean, if you think of, so yeah, I mean, I can't remember the exact functional relationship, but I mean, if you think of just P as being like, you know, taking a derivative, and then you define some new coordinates, you know, X tilde, and so then you want to define some new operator, instead of, you know, P as being ddx, it'll be some ddx tilde, and then that shift will be, you want to incorporate some shift in P.
So if vertex and beta was time independent, then they will just shift the lattice. So they
yes, yeah. So then it's yeah.
Okay, and then if it is time dependent, how do you get vector potential?
So you want to kind of reinterpret. You know, redefine your some like X tilde and Y tilde for your new lattice. And then this will induce some shift, you know, you have to redefine your P, right? Because your P is like a, in this case, your original P is like a ddx, right? Does that make sense?
Usually, in order to shift P, you have to create some modulation, like. So do you, does delta x and delta y depends on x and y? Is it as well? Such that you shape?
Yeah, sorry, yeah. I mean, yeah, sorry, these are, yeah. I mean, these are.
It's not uniform or?
No, I mean, these will be some, yeah, okay, maybe it's not obviously the way I've drawn it. Yeah, so this will be some, yeah. I mean, there'll be spatial dependence to delta x in the sense that the spatial dependence to v of x and y.
So
I mean, yeah, sorry, so you're right. I mean, I think it's just not obvious from the way I've written it, but yeah, so there'll be the spatial dependence to delta x and delta y.
The delta x delta y depends on x, y, and so on.
Yeah. I mean, the shift depends on, yeah, where you are in x, y. Yeah, sorry, I don't remember the exact functional formula offhand. I haven't looked in a while. So through this kind of this time periodic lattice shaking, they can generate you know, some sort of effective, in this case, it's really some sort of time dependent flow K Hamiltonian. But then if you you can kind of, you know, as long as your experiment's long enough, you can time average over these flow K periods, and you can get basically an effective kind of equilibrium or time independent static Hamiltonian, which has the correct staggered flux pattern that you want to generate this kind of flux pattern, okay, of fluxes through, you know, of zero net flux, but fluxes through each of these triangles. So like I was saying, so this is, you know, integer quantum, a beautiful realization of integer quantum Hall physics with Atlanta levels. So now I want to think about what about adding interactions to these kind of systems, okay? All right, and so here I'm going to kind of, so this was kind of like intro, and so here I'm kind of zooming in on a specific example, so this Haldane model, okay? So we want to think about adding just a local Hilbert interaction, okay? So an on-site interaction, and here I've also included spin, so I have kind of two copies of the Haldane model, one for spin up and one for spin down. And then I have just some local interaction between them that's just, you know, N up and down. So at half filling, and for, you know, U dominant over these hoppings, I can derive an effective spin Hamiltonian. So for U dominant, I'll be in a, you know, my system will be in a states where I just have one particle per site. And then with one particle per site, I can kind of do perturbation theory starting from there. I can do perturbation theory in T squared over U, and generate an effective Hamiltonian that just acts on the spin degrees of freedom. So here, the charge degrees of freedom are completely frozen out, okay? So once we're at large U, you know, this completely penalizes having, say, two fermions at one site or any kind of charge fluctuations, right? So we're gonna be in a mod insulating state, and we're just gonna look at the effective kind of spin Hamiltonian, okay?
Why do you want the spin Hamiltonian? Is it the original Hamiltonian closer to the experiment?
Yeah, but the original experiment, this kind of physics is already known. So this is kind of non-interacting physics, and so it's already, you know, pretty well understood. Exactly, you know, I mean, even
interactions in spin.
Yeah. So I mean, we're thinking about what happens if we add strong interactions, basically, to this kind of model. So the non-interacting, you know, non-interacting side of things is already very well known. I mean, since the 80s, and so then we want to think about, okay, what if, you know. And experimenting the system that they're working on at the moment, you know, what if they, you know, add strong interactions and go to the mod insulator?
Oh, sorry. So you use your interaction in a large U limit or something?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're looking at the limit in which, yeah, U is, you know, dominant. So we want to look at strong correlations. What kind of, you know, what kind of physics is strong correlations bring to this kind of topological band structure? So we're going to look at large U physics and just look at the so all the charge degrees of freedom are frozen out. So we're just looking at spin physics. Okay. And so then there's a kind of a standard kind of perturbation theory that you can use to go from this kind of Hubbert Hamiltonian to an effective spin Hamiltonian, okay? And it's a perturbation theory in like, is it T squared over U, okay? So at first order and order T squared over U, you get terms that are these S dot S terms, so Heisenberg-like terms. So there's one that's kind of nearest neighbor and one that's next nearest neighbor, okay? And so, but you can see that so far, you know, my original Hamiltonian had, T1, T2, and this flux phi, right, as parameters, okay? And I'm gonna fix U from now on, so I'm just gonna work at a large fixed U, okay? Whereas here, if I just stop here, the flux doesn't actually appear, okay? And it's the flux that gives you the, you know, interesting topological physics of the original model, okay? So in the original model, the Haldane model, if I have no flux at all, then I just have electrons hopping around, and they'll just have a kind of regular band structure without any kind of quantized Hall conductivity or that kind of physics, okay? So at this order, you know, we don't see any signatures of the flux, okay? That's because at this order, all these terms are generated by, you know, kind of particles kind of, you know, say, starting here, hopping, say, you know, to here and hopping back again, okay? So they hop in one direction, they pick up a phase of phi, they hop back, they pick up minus phi, so they cancel out, okay? So they don't see any of these fluxes, okay? However, if we go just the next order, so to order, you know, T cubed over U squared, then it's possible for, you know, particles to go in these three-site closed loops, and these do enclose a non-zero flux, okay?
But so what's the spin analogy of the trivial theories then here?
This is the J1, J2 model on the honeycomb lattice. So it's small, T2 over T1, it'll be a nil antiferromagnet, and then at larger, it will be, classically, it'll be a spiral, and quantum mechanically, it's some sort of valence bond solid kind of thing. So here, this will just be J1, J2 on a honeycomb lattice. Okay, and so if we go to next order, it'll be T cubed over U squared. And so here, I'm gonna get terms that depend on, so this is,
you're interested in the spin 1/2 limit?
Yes.
So that phase diagram is known for the honeycomb. That is a sign problem, right?
Yeah. So for J1, J2, I'll talk about it in a second. Yeah. So for J1, J2, there's a lot of work being done on the quantum case, the spin half case, but it's not really settled yet. That's why, in kind of when I focus on the phase diagram, I'm going to focus away from that point. So there, it's kind of like there's a lot of So basically, it's an antiferromagnet for a small T2 over T1, or small J2 over J1, and then above that, you know, classically it's spiral. But then quantum mechanically, there's a lot of competing valence bond states. And so it's not clear exactly, you know, which valence bond state wins, or maybe even there's some sort of paramagnetic state in between. And so it's kind of complicated. And there's been a lot of work already done in it, and there's not much more that we can contribute to the huge body of work that's already there. The new physics is really in these new terms. Yep.
So here, spin up and spin down see the same flux?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, sorry, actually, yeah, that's a great question. So unlike, say, the Kane-Mallet model, in which, you know, we have two copies of the Haldane model, one that sees flux and one that sees the, you know, the time reversal, you know, minus phi. Here, both copies of spin see the same flux.
I'm sure just because this is what is realized in
code. Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. So this is what's realized in experiment, yeah. And so here I've broken explicitly time reversal symmetry by having the same flux for both spin species, whereas, you know, in say the K-Mallet model, both spin species see opposite flux, and so time reversal symmetry is preserved in that case. And so that's where, and you get this kind of quantum spin Hall effect that I kind of mentioned earlier. Whereas here it's just two identical copies of the Haldane model. Okay. So far the flux doesn't appear. But if we go in this third order, then here kind of electrons or fermions can hop in it, ran in a three-site loop, and they can enclose some non-zero flux. And so there'll be some coefficient that depends on the hoppings. And there'll be sine of the flux enclosed. So here there'll be sine of minus phi if I choose the convention that you go around anti-clockwise these triangles. And then this chi is S dot S cross S. So it's like a scalar triple product.
Isn't that
time reversal? No, so this S dot S plus S term breaks time reversal symmetry.
If you change the flux phi to minus phi. So this Hamiltonian is invariant if you change S to minus S and phi to
And also phi to minus phi, yeah.
Your original Hamiltonian was not.
My original Hamiltonian, so here I've, this explicitly breaks time reversal symmetry. My new Hamiltonian also, these additional terms, I think under time reversal symmetry, if I choose the convention that I still go around in the same anti-clockwise loops. I want to flip, say, S to minus S, and also change the handedness. Like, so here I've chosen a particular handedness of going around this S dot S cross S loop.
I guess I'm pressing this simply in the original Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
If you flip the sign of the spin,
yeah,
and flip the sign of phi, it is not a symmetry, right?
So yeah, true. Yeah.
It is not, right?
So flip the sign of the spin, you mean just map up to down?
Up to down, yeah.
Yeah. So here, if I map up to down, I'm not sure exactly what that does to the triple product. Mapping up to down, I guess, isn't quite the same as mapping S to minus S, right? Yeah.
I think the sign of T2 has to be changed in the case of time reversal operator. Will you apply?
Yeah, you could interpret the, you want to interpret, sorry, I'm not sure if I'm...
The sign of T2.
Yeah.
If you apply time reversal operator in the system.
On this Hamiltonian, or?
To a spin Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
In case of spin Hamiltonian. The power of T2 is 1, okay? And it depends on its sign. If you change the sign of T2, is physics change?
If I change the sign of T2, yeah. Certainly you can see that even from the original model. If I change the sign of T2, it'll change. It'll be like shifting phi by pi, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Does this affect the physics? Change of phase by pi?
So you're in the spin model or in the original model, sorry?
The original model.
So the original model, so with our interactions, the phase diagram is kind of, I think I had it a second ago. This phase diagram, this is phi as a function of, so this is phi from minus pi to pi. So it has this kind of figure of eight structure. So if I'm over here and I want to say shift by pi, these kind of, this lobe structure is reflection symmetric about phi equals zero, I guess. Okay. So, in the non-Artin case, it's the physics from, zero to pi is the same as the physics basically from zero to minus pi, just that you have to just, the time reversal partners. So here you'll get, instead of quantized Hall commutative plus one, you get quantized Hall commutative minus one. So the original non-Artin model has this kind of, I guess if you do reflection symmetry by phi equals zero and follow it up with time reversal, that would be a symmetry.
With Flux, both models break some time rules.
With Flux, both models break time rules, exactly. So the Flux explicitly breaks. So for example, if I stop here, this model does not break time reversal symmetry. However, it's only by including these kind of three-spin interactions that I break time reversal symmetry. And I don't think, I think if I flip S to minus S, I flip phi, I'm not sure if that will cover it, because I think I'll still have a, I mean, I have to choose like a handedness for this triple product S and S cross S. And that will, once I choose that handedness, you know, I could either choose this is going anti-clockwise or clockwise. Those are the two kind of time reversal partners.
So here you keep, I see two spin rotations in there.
Yes, I do, yeah, exactly. I keep, yeah, so which is in there in the original model. So I keep SE2 spin rotational symmetry. And in fact, if you think about it, if I wanted a three spin term and the Hamiltonian has to be a scalar, and I want to keep SE2 symmetry, then actually the only scalar SE2 symmetric term I can write down is S dot S cross S. So kind of without doing any calculations, you can already tell that at this order, I have to generate a term like S dot S cross S. And then the perturbation theory just kind of tells you the coefficients of this term. I could have chosen this S dot S cross S to be kind of clockwise or anti-clockwise, and those would be the kind of time reversal partners. And so once I choose a particular handedness, say going anti-clockwise in this case, then I break time reversal symmetry and I have chosen a particular, a particular handedness. If I included both handedness, both anti-clockwise and clockwise, then I could just do some manipulation to get those two terms to cancel and be zero. So once I choose, a particular S dot S cross S, then that explicitly breaks time reversal symmetry in the spin model. So there'll be terms that like S dot S cross S on these smaller triangles and S dot S cross S on these larger triangles. So these smaller ones enclose minus phi and these enclose 3 phi, okay. And so now this is nice because it's kind of a natural competition in the spin model because these S dot S terms, a term like S dot S with this kind of positive coefficient, one spins to be, kind of collinear, right? Like anti-fermatically aligned, okay? Whereas a term like S dot S cross S wants the three spins to be, if we think classically, it wants the three spins to be orthogonal to one another, okay? There's kind of a natural competition between terms that want, the spins to be collinear and terms that want the spins to be completely orthogonal, okay? So you can imagine that as I tune kind of coefficients, I'll generate an interesting phase diagram, okay? Because of the competition between these different types of terms, right? So the first way one could study this phase diagram is just using classical Monte Carlo. So just looking at classical magnetic orders, make this colorful phase diagram. So as I said before, I'm plotting flux phi against the ratio of the Hoppings T2 over T1. As Roger pointed out, at flux phi, you just get the J1, J2 model. And so here it's known that you have some nail to spiral transition, okay? This model has already been well studied by many people over many years. So it's kind of no new physics to discover over here, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the kind of right-hand side of this phase diagram, okay? Which has not been studied before, okay? So I'm going to look over here, right? So there's a variety of different phases. So there's a nail phase here at kind of small T2 over T1. There's some kind of intermediate phases here that I won't discuss. There's this large region of tetrahedral order. Then there's what we kind of call these triad kind of phases. These triad phases are interesting in this classical phase diagram, but they're not so important to my story later on, so I'm not going to really go through them. If you're interested, you can certainly ask me about them. I'm just kind of like, this is the unit cell, and this is somewhat kind of what the orders look like. But the kind of main phase I want to focus on here is the tetrahedral phase, okay? So there's an 8-site magnetic unit cell in the honeycomb lattice, and this is a common outcome plot of the spin, so I've taken, a particular Monte Carlo, kind of ground state, and in each site I have a spin that points in a particular direction on the unit sphere. And what I've done is I've just plotted all of those points on kind of one unit sphere. Okay, and so you can see that all of the spins point to four particular points, and these four points are the four corners of a tetrahedron. Okay, so basically all of the spins in the lattice point towards the four corners of a tetrahedron, and those four spins are kind of aligned across the lattice in this particular unit cell structure. Okay.
Sorry. What's the classical model
of the
discussion?
Oh, sorry, it's exactly the spin model, sorry, yeah. I mean, I've just taken the spin model and then the classical analysis of the spin model, sorry.
But what does it mean to make a classical analysis of this model?
Oh, sorry, yeah, okay, good question, sorry. So basically I'm assuming that, so this is some quantum Hamiltonian, but basically I'm assuming that, S, assumes some, I'm replacing S basically by its expectation value. So I'm replacing all of the S's by just kind of, classical, numbers. This becomes just, these S's just become basically just kind of, unit vectors.
So unit vectors, very large unit vectors. Is that the limit of very large spin?
Yeah. So limit very large spinning, which I can just replace S by just some classical expectation value. Yeah. Yeah. So S by expectation value S. Yeah.
So you said Monte Carlo.
Classical Monte Carlo, sorry.
Does that mean you're simulating this at finite temperature?
Yeah, so we did do finite temperature studies. That's in a kind of previous work that I'm so in this
fixed temperature?
I did this is basically zero temperature. So these are the grand state.
So there's no thermal fluctuation.
Sorry?
And there's no thermal fluctuations?
So basically what I've done is I've kind of started at some high temperature, and then I've kind of annealed down to some very low temperature and looked at what the kind of phases we find at this low temperature.
You just look for the minimum place curve.
Exactly, yeah. So we have a previous study, you know, paper in which we've looked at effects of thermal fluctuations. We can talk about that later if you want. And so there are some interesting, for example, these kind of triad states break certain lattice symmetries. And so they break some sort of discrete symmetry. So then as you heat the system up, there's some sort of that discrete symmetry is restored. And so it's like a kind of clock transition because it's some discrete symmetry breaking transition. So we've looked at kind of, you know, finite temperature effects of these spin orders and use Monte Carlo to like calculate critical exponents and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of interesting, thermal physics and finite temperature physics, this kind of thing, classically. But that's something that is not the particular focus of this talk. But we've looked at that, yeah.
Yep. Non-copilar,
yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. So this nail state at small t2 over t1 is collinear, obviously, but all of these other states are non-coplanar states. That's correct. Yeah. So both of these states, these triads, are this is kind of what they look like on a unit sphere. They're some non-coplanar states, and the tetrahedral is also some non-coplanar state. So they're all once you get to large enough at t2 over t1, they're all non-coplanar. So like I said, I won't discuss these triads in this talk. And,
are they all commensurate?
This is a commensurate order. These particular states are not. They have a very weak incommensuration. So very, very weak incommensuration. If you think of a kind of perfect order, which is kind of what these symbols indicate, or sorry, what these drawings are trying to like portray, and then you look at the spin structure factor, say, of that order, and you look at the spin structure factor, you actually get a Monte Carlo, the peaks just shifted very slightly off the high symmetry points. So it's like a very weak incommensuration to them. And that's why, you know, there's actually kind of some kind of spiraling kind of to these states. But it's very weak, very long wavelength. It's kind of difficult to see a Monte Carlo actually sometimes. So far I've been discussing just classical phase diagram, okay. But originally we started with quantum spin Hamiltonian, okay. So you might ask, what kind of physics here survives if I go to the S equals a half limit, okay? Which is what we're interested in, right? So to do that, we did exact diagonalization on 18, 24, 32 site clusters. And we used a kind of variety of different, you know, signatures to map out the phase diagram. So this is the phase diagram for a 24 site cluster. So you can see if I compare it to, you know, what we had before, you know, we have nail here, down here. So these kind of white fuzzy lines are phase transitions. They're kind of broad into kind of some sort of finite size effect. And we have this tetrahedral in the triads. So the tetrahedral of the triads, it's a kind of hatched phase where it's not entirely clear. Some finite size effects going on, it's not entirely clear what's going on, but maybe broaden phase transition. But you know, it looks pretty similar to what I'd drawn before. Okay, in terms of phases, phase boundaries will shift around a little bit, okay. But a lot of the physics survives, right? And the background color here that I've drawn is S dot S cross S on the small triangles. So it's almost zero in the nail because it's like a collinear state. The tetrahedral is large, and the triad is large, but opposite sign it's just kind of different magnitude in these two states. And so again, here the state that I want to focus on is this tetrahedral phase, okay? And so the reason I want to focus on it is that it's an example of what's called a regular magnetic order. So a regular magnetic order is a magnetic order that respects all lattice symmetries modulo global spin transformations. So what that means is that if I take this, you know, magnetic state, I do some sort of lattice symmetry, so say like a lattice rotation or some of that, I can always follow that up with a global spin transformation, and I'll get back to the same state, okay? This is a thing of kind of classical magnetic states, okay? So it only breaks kind of these lattice symmetries respects these lattice symmetries modulo global spin transformations, right? So what that means is that if, for example, I started with a kind of regular magnetic order, and I restored spin rotational symmetry, okay? And that means I'd be left with a state that doesn't break any symmetries, okay? So, you know, a counterexample of this kind of state would be something like a spin spiral, okay? If it spirals along a particular direction, all right? then if I say do a lattice rotational spiral along a different direction than the lattice, but there's no global spin transformation I can do to make it look like the original state, okay? And so if I kind of disorder this spiral, I'll be left with some sort of kind of leftover kind of lattice symmetry broken state, okay? But in regular magnetic order, if I restore spin rotational symmetry, then I'll be left with a state that doesn't break any symmetries at all, okay? And so that's kind of interesting because that's the kind of natural starting point for kind of quantum spin liquid states, okay? So I'll talk about quantum spin liquids. So quantum spin liquids, one signature is that the states are kind of fully symmetric, okay? So they don't break any lattice symmetries, for example. So they provide another example of this kind of topological order. So it's kind of fractional quantum Hall-like physics, okay? They're disordered states, so they're quantum paramagnets. So they have exponentially decaying spin-spin correlations, right? There's a lot of kind of experimental work and theoretical work going into them, but there's no kind of getting conclusive proof is a little difficult. That's kind of currently lacking. Here's a picture of a spin liquid. And they've been originally kind of proposed that were extremely popular in the high-TC cuprates. They kind of like found a renaissance in like late 90s in frustrated magnets. They've also been influential and kind of been influenced by other fields such as quantum dimer models, lattice gauge theory. Maybe topological quantum computing, because maybe you could use excitations of these systems to do some sort of quantum computing, but I think that's very far in the future. And then I was also looking at kind of Google images for spin liquids, and apparently spin liquids are also popular quiz questions as well on these kind of shows, okay? So you can, at the end, you can tell me why you think the answer is. And so there's different ways of thinking about spin liquids. So one is this kind of the original idea by Anderson, actually, when he introduced it in the 70s, is as a resonating valence bond state. So here, Anderson envisioned the wave function as a superposition of different singular pairings. So here I've drawn a square lattice. At each side in the lattice, there's a spin. And these kind of red kind of dimers represent some singular pair, OK? And so the wave function is some superposition of all different ways of tying the lattice with these kind of singular pairs, OK? And then one can imagine a kind of ordered state of valence bonds. So here, the wave function for spin liquid, the wave function is some massive superposition. One can imagine another state in which you just have a fixed orientation of bonds. That's something called like a valence bond crystal. So one way is thinking about spin liquids as these resonating valence bond states. Another way is to think about them as a kind of disordered state, okay, quantum disordered state. Okay, so I can start with something that's like an ordered magnetic or valence bond kind of parent state, okay? So some magnetic state that's magnetic order, some valence bond state that's ordered. Then I can think about tuning some parameter in my Hamiltonian that frustrates that order. Okay, and so frustration could become strong enough, and quantum fluctuation might be strong enough that I'll actually completely melt that magnetic order or that valence bond order, and produce some quantum spin liquid state. Okay, so for example, on a square lattice, this is a spin spiral in a square lattice. It's kind of kind of conjectured that one can melt the spin spiral in a square lattice and produce a particular type of spin liquid, get a Z2 spin liquid, okay? So you kind of completely disorder the state, and so that the spin-spin correlations kind of go away, but somehow kind of get some sort of non-trivial topological character to it, okay? All right, and so in this talk, I'm gonna kind of focus on thinking about a particular type of spin liquid as a quantum disordered state. And a particular type of spin liquid I want to talk about is what's called a chiral spin liquid, right? So this is a spin liquid that has broken time reversal symmetry, which is good because our spin Hamiltonian is broken time reversal symmetry. And there's this non-zero spin chirality S dot S cross S, which is also good because we're starting with states that have non-zero S dot S cross S, okay? So this is the kind of spin liquid that we want to generate, okay? So what are those kind of properties? The key properties I'll focus on in this talk are these two. So it has a twofold grand state degeneracy on a torus. So later on, I'll be showing results, numerical calculations on a torus. And it also has a total many-body Chern number, which is kind of if you thread flux through each hole of the torus and kind of integrate over those threaded fluxes, for both grand states, you should get one, okay? A kind of question is how do such, so chiral spin liquids have been extremely popular in recent years. There's been a variety of different spin models, and I'll kind of come back to that at the end, that have found these. But the kind of key questions, remain as to kind of how such phases emerge, right? So we have many examples, but how do they really kind of like, can we understand how and why they emerge? And is there some sort of common mechanism that unites the kind of various quantum spin liquids, or chiral spin liquids that have been found so far, okay? And so first off, I'm gonna use the honeycomb lattice as an example of kind of maybe answering some of these questions, okay? So, you know, we started with this tetrahedral state, okay? And we want to think about, you know, can we disorder this tetrahedral state and get this this spin liquid, okay? And so one way of kind of thinking about how we might go about disordering it is that spins that are on opposite sides of the honeycomb are ferromagnetically aligned with one another, okay? So that means that if we have, say, if I add, say, an additional third nearest neighbor hopping, so our original Hamiltonian had this first neighbor hopping, second nearest neighbor hopping with this kind of phase structure, right? So if I add a third neighbor hopping, okay, then if I do this, you know, perturbation theory and I generate my spin model, then I'm gonna get an additional S dot S term, okay? So again, a term that's like four T three squared over U S dot S, okay? So I'm gonna be starting with, you know, a state in which these spins across the honeycomb are ferromagnetically aligned. I'm gonna be adding some anti-ferromagnetic interaction between them, okay? So you can imagine if I crank up that anti-ferromagnetic interaction large enough, I'm gonna destabilize the magnetic order and I'm gonna destroy it, okay?
So this isn't part of your original perturbation theory?
This is not yet. This is an addition that I'm making on.
But those two chiral terms you had, they competed at some,
yeah, so
at some region where that phase bound.
Yeah, in the next slide, or maybe more, I'm gonna show the new spin Hamiltonian in the next slide, and yeah, maybe more clear. But essentially, the strategy is that we're starting with this, you know, state for these spins of ferromagnetic line. I want to just add the next simplest thing, which is a third neighbor hopping, and destabilize the spin magnetic order, and see what's left over. Okay. And so, you know, as Roger was pointing out, so we're going to get this new spin Hamiltonian. So we're going to get this new S dot S term. We're also going to get this a new type of S dot S cross S term. Okay. So it looks kind of complicated. But what we're going to do is we're going to here set phi as pi over 3. So this big flux that encloses sine of 3 phi. So if I set pi over 3, then I'll get sine of pi, and so then this is gonna go away, okay? So I'm gonna get rid of that. And this term, you know, we've had the phase diagram with and without this term. I have it in my additional slides if you wanna see it. But it really doesn't affect the physics much, it just surrounds the phase boundary slightly. So these terms are kind of unimportant. So what's really driving the physics is these Heisenberg terms, plus this small triangle chiral term, okay? And in fact, if these Heisenberg terms were not there, so they were just zero, let's say, and the Hamiltonian only consisted of this term, okay, then the ground state would be a tetrahedral, okay? So it'd be this tetrahedral order that we want to melt, okay? So this term is what's giving us the tetrahedral, okay? Right? And then these additional terms are kind of what's frustrating it, okay? And, you know, hopefully melting it, okay? Does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah, I guess I was just wondering also, how do you know that the, back to the original, maybe go back one more. How do you know that the original competition between those two chiral terms, if you want to call them that, don't give rise to a spin liquid in a region where you have drawn this rough phase boundary? Like, how sure are you that you have a phase transition there, like a single phase transition?
Oh, sorry, yeah, that's a good question, yeah. So here, so along here, it's not actually completely clear. So here, there could be, between the nail tetrahedral, it could be actually that there's a very small window. You'll kind of see that on these seconds later. However, it's so small that it's kind of, you know, hard to, you know, publish a paper saying it's there. So it's, you know, there's a very small window here where you're right. It could be that this competition leads to a very small window, but it's
because you only have
EB. We have EB and BMR G, but and even in that case, it's kind of not clear. I mean, there's no very good, you know, signatures weren't, you know, errors were quite large, I guess, in the signatures. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. So we need to add something to make it extend at this region. Okay. So, you know, you'd think that maybe there's a very small kind of like, you know, window here. Now we want to add another axis to basically, you know, expand at that region. Okay. And that's exactly what we want to do by adding this additional term. So we want to make this region bigger. Okay. So we're going to start with this state here. We're going to take a little cut. Okay. So at pi by 3 from this tetrahedral nail, and then we're going to add this T3. Okay. And so now this is the phase diagram with a T3. So you can see that there's before I get to the nail, there's this region of chiral spin liquid, okay? So you can imagine, say, for example, that if I start in the tetrahedral here, okay, I have these ferromagnetically aligned spins across the honeycomb, right? Then I crank up this anti-ferromagnetic interaction, okay? And eventually, you know, this tetrahedral order is completely destabilized, kind of melted away, okay? And it gets a liquid-like state. That liquid-like state retains the chirality of the origin, of the parent state, okay? So the color here, like I said, is the chirality. So you can see that in the chiral spin liquid, the tetrahedral, they both have this large, small triangle chirality. So I have some like melted kind of liquid-like state with non-zero chirality, and it has all the topological properties that you expect for a chiral spin liquid. So such as if we look at the spectrum, say at this point here, this is the energy spectrum from exact ionization. So on this left-hand side are the singlets, here, these are the triplets. So for a spin liquid, the ground states should be a singlet. So you can see that here there's these two low-lying states, kind of quasi-degenerate, so it's on a finite-sized system, so we're never going to get exact degeneracy. But this twofold quasi-degenerate ground state, they have a total many-body Chernow of 1, which is one of the characteristics of this corresponding liquid state. And there's a big kind of spin gap here to the rest of the spectrum, okay? Here, this is in units of E over N, but I guess in units of E, the spin gap is actually extremely large, okay? So there's a very large spin gap to the rest of the spectrum. And the kind of colors here represent the momentum of the state, so in the Brillouin zone, okay? Okay, so that's one particular signature, this twofold quasi-degenerate ground state, okay? But there's a lot of other signatures, okay? I won't have time to kind of go through all of them. In fact, I'm not sure what time I'm supposed to finish at. Or...
Just start wrapping up.
Okay, yeah. So I'll just mention that there's... So Lukasz worked with us doing DMRG in these states. And so Lukasz and Gufri have kind of pioneered work on how one can extract different topological properties of these states using DMRG, okay? So, for example, these topological S&T matrices would encode the kind of braiding properties of the quasi-particles. So I guess I don't have too much time, so maybe I'll just kind of skip through this. But one can imagine, S is generated by some 90-degree rotation. And so you can kind of, rotate kind of one of these. These are kind of anions running through the holes of the torus. And S is kind of, it's just a phase acquired by quasi-particle I when it encircles some quasi-particle J, okay? So Lukasz has this these numerical results. And this is to be compared to the exact results here, okay? So you see there's an extremely nice agreement. For example, here, this number here, it should be 1. This is the central charge. That's 0.96. Here we have 1, 1, it's 0.99, 0.97, so very nice, okay? Another thing that, I won't go through in detail, but one can also look at the entanglement spectrum, again, using DMRG. And this should reflect the entanglement spectrum of a corresponding liquid, which is known to have a very particular structure, this conformal field theory structure. And so one sees this kind of classic conformal field theory counting 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 in each of these kind of sectors, okay? There's two ground states. So then just before I get to the kind of like very last thing, this is kind of an, I've mentioned that this tetrahedral, this corresponding liquid, say, can be imagined as some kind of disordered tetrahedral. So the question to ask is, what happens if you cross this transition, okay? Is it first order, is it continuous, et cetera, okay? So far numerics, about ED and DMRG don't show any signs of first order behavior as you go across this transition, okay? And, using finite size systems, one can never prove that a transition is first, okay, one can never prove that it's continuous, certainly, okay? Weak first order transitions are almost impossible to rule out, but so far there's no evidence for any kind of first order behavior, okay? So this is kind of an excellent candidate for some kind of, exotic kind of continuous quantum phase transition between, symmetry broken state without any topological properties and a state that, with spin rotational symmetry, but that has these kind of interesting topological properties. So a topologically ordered state without magnetic symmetry breaking and a state with magnetic symmetry breaking but no topological order. So I won't go through this kind of in this talk, but we've shown that you can kind of qualitatively capture this kind of physics using some kind of field theory with bosonic spin-ons. You can ask about it afterwards if you're interested. So then just before I wrap up, I just want to kind of, so here I've been talking about this specific example, this Haldane model. So I just want to kind of zoom out a little bit and talk about kind of bigger picture physics here, okay? So what has looking at this specific example taught us about chiral spin liquids and how they might emerge, okay? So there's kind of two points here to keep in mind, right? One is that I mentioned that the, this tetrahedral is a regular magnetic order, right? Which is one of these kind of good starting points for these chiral spin liquids. So these have been classified in this paper here for all of the 2D lattices, so honeycomb, triangle, square, and kagome. So all of the regular magnetic orders have been constructed and they're known, okay? So in some sense, we have all of the kind of, possible parent states are known, okay? And the second point is that in recent years, there's been a lot of, SE2 invariant spin models that have been shown to have chiral spin liquid ground states for all of these lattices as well, okay? So then the question is there kind of a connection between them, okay? So can we imagine that these states, on the honeycomb, we've seen that, this tetrahedral regular magnetic order can act as a parent state for this chiral spin liquid? And so we want to ask, can the chiral spin liquids that have been found in other examples, can they also be understood as kind of quantum disordered parent regular magnetic orders, okay? So this is kind of ongoing work, so this would be a whole other talk, kind of basically, so I'll just kind of flash some kind of thing. So we've already looked at the honeycomb lattice, which was kind of this talk. So in the triangle lattice, there's also a tetrahedral state, which is a regular magnetic order, okay? And then later work, so it's kind of more recent, has shown that this is the phase diagram from exact ionization, that is a chiral spin liquid. And this red region here is a tetrahedral. So in that case, there's also a tetrahedral proximate to a chiral spin liquid. And so we have numerics going across the transition in ED and DMG. And again, there's no signs of any first order behavior. So again, this looks similar to the honeycomb, in which it could be a kind of continuous kind of melting transition. You start with this tetrahedral parent state, you disorder it, and you go into this chiral spin liquid state. Okay. On the square lattice, kind of much earlier work by Surak and his collaborators, shown that there's a chiral spin liquid on the square lattice for a similar kind of Hamiltonian. There's also a tetrahedral state that's a regular magnetic order on a square lattice. It can be distorted, so it's kind of a continuous family of tetrahedral states. And so we have kind of ED and some DMG work on this as well, and we can show that you can start from this chiral spin liquid on the square lattice. Or I should say, maybe you start from this tetrahedral state on the square lattice. You can frustrate it, disorder it, and get a chiral spin liquid. Okay. So again, here this tetrahedral state acts as some sort of parent state for the chiral spin liquid. All right. So then, lastly, the kind of most troublesome lattice, unfortunately, is the Kagome lattice. So here, there's a number of different regular magnetic orders that are non-coplanar, so they have non-zero S dot S cross S. And there's a number of models actually that have been shown to harbor chiral spin liquid states as well, okay? So this is, say, J1, J2, J3 on the Kagome. There's a chiral spin liquid. This is J1, J-chi. This is earlier work by Lukash and collaborators, where they also see a chiral spin liquid region. So kind of, ongoing work with Lukash is answering the question of whether there's a connection between, these, regular magnetic order parent states and one of these chiral spin liquids, okay? Here, there's a transition between a QBOC 1 and a chiral spin liquid, but this is shown to be first order, okay? It's pretty heavily first order, okay? So we want to see if there's some way of, starting from one of these regular magnetic orders and disordering it and getting the chiral spin liquid. If that's the case, then we'll kind of like be able to complete the story. And in all the two-dimensional lattices, we'll be able to think about the chiral spin liquids that have been seen so far as being quantum disordered versions of these regular magnetic order parent states, okay? And that's the kind of like bigger picture, okay? So if you want to think about how do chiral spin liquids emerge, all right, one of the ways, we hope, is that one can think of them emerging, through kind of melting or disordering these parent states, okay? And we've identified the parent states already on some of these lattices, okay? So then I'll just leave with conclusions. So we found that the model limit of the specific Haldane-Hubbard model has a lot of different chiral magnetic orders. Adding an additional Hopping term frustrates this order and leads to a chiral spin liquid. So ongoing work on other lattices suggests that this is kind of a more ubiquitous phenomena. We can understand the emergence of chiral spin liquids through kind of quantum disordering regular magnetic orders. There's still a lot more work needed to think about the nature of the chiral spin liquid. So what kind of symmetry it projectively kind of breaks. The field theory of the transition, which I kind of briefly mentioned, and kind of more detailed aspects of the experiment as well. Thank you very much.
Symmetry breaking cameras of the broken the classical one?
So for example, I could have started with a spin Hamiltonian that has just say Heisenberg terms, and so it doesn't have non-zero S dot S cross S. Then I could I could find that my ground state spontaneously breaks, spontaneously generates some non-zero S dot S cross S. And so then, you spontaneously break some discrete symmetry. So then you can look at, say, for example, thermal fluctuations to restore that symmetry. So there's other kind of models and, things that people have looked at. I think Christian Batista's looked at, where, they start with some spin model, the ground state spontaneously breaks time reversal, spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry and has this non-zero S dot S cross S. And they look at, what happens as you increase temperature. And you go through some symmetry breaking transition. So in this particular case, because I broke it by hand in the beginning, as you increase temperature, there'll be no transition. S dot S cross S is already, it's broken by hand and so on.
So I could buy identifying these ground states with ED and DMRG, but I can't buy studying the interesting quantum phase transition using these methods.
Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
I get it. I'm just saying, is there, using your mechanism of disordering these classical models, can you find a Hamiltonian that doesn't have a sign problem that might have a CSL?
That's a great question. So when I said studying these transitions, what I really meant was just kind of, looking for kind of, first order behavior. So extracting things like critical exponents and things like that, and DMG is certainly extremely difficult, and even in ED with finite size, it's pretty difficult. So when I meant studying, I meant more just, kind of investigating whether, the signatures of first order behavior, things like that.
Hamiltonian that has a spin like that doesn't have a sign problem?
I don't know if it, yeah. But I mean, that's not to say that it does not exist. And I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, I can't answer whether it does or does not exist in the.
So you emphasized the route where you start from regular Malin computer and then quantum disorder.
Yeah.
So how about non regular Malin computer? Can you?
Yeah, so I mean, those states are
what's special about regular Malin?
Yeah, great question. Yeah. So I briefly mentioned. So I mean, so the regular Malin orders, they only break these lattice symmetries, these discrete lattice symmetries, modulo global spin transformations. So the idea then is that if I restore spin rotational symmetry, I'll be left over a state that doesn't break any symmetries. Whereas if I have a state that's not a regular Malin order, say for example a spiral, if I so that breaks lattice symmetries. And that breaks lattice symmetries such that if I, do a lattice symmetry, there's no spin transformation that can bring me back to the original state. So in that case, if I disordered such a state, I would expect that I'd be left with a quantum disordered state that still breaks that lattice symmetry. So regular Malin orders are kind of special in that, they only break lattice symmetries, modulo these global spin transformations. So with restoration of spin rotational symmetry, leads to a fully symmetric state.
Where translational symmetry is broken, but spin rotation is like a valence bond solid, like that?
You mean an example of something that's not a regular Malin order?
What are the examples that you have in mind? Like if you start from non-regular Malin order, frustrated, what are the examples?
Yeah, so for example, something like an incommensurate spiral or something like that, that breaks lattice symmetries in such a way that, if I disorder it and restore spin transformational symmetry, that lattice symmetry should still be kind of broken.
So what kind of state do you have
in
the final state after
I can sorry, you mean what kind of disordered state does it become? You mean,
so you suppose you start with
a non-regular Malin order, and I disorder it.
And you add some frustration.
Yeah.
And what kind of final state do you
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, there's no reason. So I guess there's no reason to believe that it should be a symmetric spin liquid. So it could either, transition just directly into some other magnetic state, or it's possible that it could, form some sort of singlet state, but some sort of ordered singlet state, like a valence bond crystal or something like that. So it could be like you suggested, some sort of, singlet state, but that's ordered like a valence bond crystal. Or, I mean, it could just straight transition into a different, there's many cases in which, I showed, in my other phase diagrams, which you start with the tetrahedral, for example, in, here, if I start with the tetrahedral and I kind of melt it here, there's no spin liquid, I just go straight to these triads. So, I mean, it's more common to just have a direct magnetic transition between one magnetic state and another.
So is there some empirical evidence or is there some theoretical argument that tells us that maybe it's easier to achieve quantum spin liquid starting from regular Malin quantum? What is the?
Yeah, so I guess the kind of like intuition is that if you want a spin liquid, that a spin liquid shouldn't break any symmetries like lattice, or it shouldn't enlarge the unit cell, so it shouldn't break translational symmetry, it shouldn't break lattice symmetries.
Not necessarily. Spin liquid
with
broken symmetry together.
I guess I'm talking specifically about symmetric spin liquids. That intuition for symmetric spin liquids, I guess, are more normal, or they're more widely seen. And so in that case, especially for chiral spin liquids, I don't know of any chiral spin liquid that breaks other symmetries apart from time reversal, for example, of the chiral spin liquids that have been found so far. So in that case, if you want to think of those as your end states, your natural kind of end states, these fully symmetric states, then your natural kind of starter state, should be a regular Malin order. You're right. I mean, there are spin liquids that can exist with broken translational, broken symmetries, but I'm as far as I know, those are much more rare and not as commonly seen. And in the chiral spin liquid case, I don't know of any examples where that's seen. All the final states are symmetric. They don't break lattice symmetries.
Any further questions? Okay, let's thank Kieran again.